It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. I think I will be haunted for a long, long time by a remarkable book that I've just finished reading called The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. The author, Judy Battalion, is telling us a story that, particularly in its fascinating specifics, has been largely untold and largely forgotten. We hear many stories about resistance efforts in various parts of Europe during the Second World War, resistance against Hitler and the Nazis. But this particular story is especially fascinating because it involves all kinds of young women. I mean, many of them teenagers who were engaged in incredibly dangerous resistance work. And the story of that is gathered together in this very, very fine book, beautifully written, meticulously researched, and the product of many, many years of careful effort. The author, Judy Battalion, before this has written White Walls, a memoir about motherhood, daughterhood, and the mess in between. And her fine writing has appeared in many, many places. And this book, published by William & Morrow, is again called The Light of Days. Judy Battalion, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be here.
It's an incredible book. Explain to our listeners how you first became aware of this largely untold story of young women in the resistance in Poland.
Sure. This entire book started by accident. It was a serendipitous find. I never intended to write about World War II or the Holocaust. I was actually living in London at the time. This was 14 years ago. And I was thinking a lot about my Jewish identity. I am the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. And I was actually writing a performance piece that looked a little bit at Jewish women who had confronted danger. It was something I was interested in. And I was just doing some research at the British Library, calling out books, and I happened to find one book that was unusual. It was kind of an old, dusty book with a blue fabric cover and gold embossed writing, and it was in Yiddish. And it was called Frauen in die Ghettos, Women in the Ghettos. But even more unusual than the book is the fact that I speak Yiddish. So I was very intrigued, and I start flipping through this book. But it was nothing like what I expected. This was a book listing, I mean, dozens and dozens of names of young Jewish women who had fought the Nazis from within the Polish ghettos. It had sort of little snippets about their lives, some photographs, chapter titles like ammunition and weapons and partisan combat. And this was so different from any Holocaust narrative I'd heard or grown up with that I was jolted. I was really stunned. And that's how it all began.
Mm. So you did some investigating, and you were able to find out a remarkable amount of information and eventually sat down to write this extraordinary book. Before we talk about that, I want you to explain some of the reasons, and you give us an array of reasons, why so many of these Jewish women who were part of the resistance in Poland, in effect, went underground, or largely so, and how some of them may have told their story for a while and then stopped, or others told their story, but those stories were suppressed or forgotten, and some of them chose really not to tell their stories at all. But you give us, towards the end of the book, some really intriguing reasons why this particular story from resistance against the Nazis was so largely unknown today.
Sure. So this became a huge question for me. It was almost the sub question to all my research. On the one hand, I was investigating what happened, what is the story, but also what happened to the story. How come I didn't know about this? It was so it was large in scale and so dramatic and so incredible. How could I not have known this? And I did, as you say, I talk about this more in the book, and I came up with many sort of reasons for this. Some of them are political, having to do with how the narrative of the Holocaust has been shaped by some political forces, in particular in Israel, perhaps in Poland. Some of it is zeitgeist, and I think we're interested in different elements of the war at different times. But a lot of it is also personal. As you said before, many of these women did not tell the story, or they told it right at the beginning and then put it behind them. And there are a few reasons for that. On the one hand, these women, and the ones who survived, of course, often felt misunderstood or that they weren't believed. Some of them felt accused of having fled their families to fight or even of sleeping their way to safety. Many of them really felt a very pungent survivor's guilt. They even though their own stories were so traumatic and dramatic, they felt that compared to their survivor peers who had been through Auschwitz, they'd actually not had it that bad as resistance fighters. So they almost felt like they didn't have a right to tell their story. Mm. And then finally, silence was also, I think, a means of coping for many of these women. As you said, they were really young. When the war was over, they were in their early 20s, and they had their whole lives ahead of them, but with no family, no home, not even a nationality. They were refugees living in new countries, often completely alone, and they really needed to start fresh for many of them. And so it was, especially these were women, they also felt a great duty to have children, to repopulate the Jewish people, and they wanted to raise their new families in as healthy and happy an environment as they could. So for all these reasons combined, these stories really got repressed for many decades.
Mm. I was intrigued by one other reason that you cite in this chapter, and I want to just read what you have written. Many writers fear that glorifying resistors places too much focus on agency, implying that survival was more than luck, judging those who did not take up arms and ultimately blaming the victim. I'd never stopped to think about that, but I think you are absolutely right that if one doesn't write about this or tell this story very carefully, it can sort of devolve into a scenario in which you have these scared people over here, too frightened to resist, and these other people over here who are courageous enough to take up arms or to, in whatever way they can to resist. And that does a grave disservice to the thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews who were consumed by the Holocaust. I mean, that would be a grave misjustice to them to think of this in that way. And I can really see how in the telling of that story, one might be really fearful about doing that. And I suspect you thought about that as well.
Well, of course, it was in the book. I thought about it all the time. I mean, as I said, my own family are Holocaust survivors. They were not part of the organized resistance that I write about. So, of course, this was never my intention. And what I do try to do in the book is open up the question of what is resistance? And, you know, there's so many different ways in which people were resilient and defiant. And that goes from, you know, telling a joke to relieve fear, all the way to, as some of these women did, you know, blowing up Nazi trains. So there really is a large range of activity that is part of the struggle and part of the reality.
You write in the introduction to the book, Holocaust scholars have debated what counts as an act of Jewish resistance. And some would draw a distinction between resistance and resilience, and indeed there is a wide gamut of what we are talking about. One other overarching question I'm anxious to ask you about: you delayed sitting down and actually writing this book. I mean, after doing all kinds of research. You know, first of all, give our listeners a sense of how many years we are talking about of research, and then how many years of delay, and what was behind that delay before you finally sat down to ultimately write The Light of Days?
Good question. I began this project 14 years ago. That's when I found this Yiddish book by accident. And it took me... 10 years, really, until I was able to make this a full-time project. And some of that was, my own work, and I think how trends even in what people were interested in the war and publishing. And some of it, really, though, it was emotional. It was my own difficulty in sitting down with such difficult material. When I found this original Yiddish source material, I was young. I was 30. I was single. I was, you know, living in London and working in the art world and doing performance. And the last place I wanted to spend my afternoons was Warsaw in 1943. But it took until a bit later. But I also immediately knew this was an incredible story, so I never let it go. I worked on it in bits here and there. First, I received a translation grant to translate the original text, which was in Yiddish, that inspired this. And I did that over a number of years. And then I actually started working on this as an academic publication and then as a fictional novel. And it was really when the women's marches started in early 2017 that it suddenly dawned on me that there might be a greater cultural interest in these stories and stories of women organizing to come together to fight for justice and liberty. And that's when I mentioned it to my literary agent. And she actually was the one who was shocked. She said, "This really happened? Jewish women were having guns taped to their torsos and shooting Nazis?" And I said, "Yes, that's what I found." And she was the one who convinced me that this really had to be a nonfiction book. I really had to tell this true story. And of course, she was right. And I finally sort of found it. I found it in myself to go there and to emotionally sit with these very difficult testimonies and memoirs day in and day out.
You write, "I knew how hard this project would be emotionally, intellectually, ethically, politically. The idea of spending my days in 1943 felt as if I would be removing myself from the contemporary world, from being present in my own life." And yet you did, and we're glad you did. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Judy Battalion about her book, The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. It's important for our listeners to understand that much of this activity with these young women, again, many of them teenagers, sprang from some of the youth organizations that already existed before the Nazi invasion of Poland in 1939. Briefly, just tell our listeners a little bit about what some of these organizations were like and why they were such an important springboard for this resistance activity.
Sure, that's a great question, a really important context for this activity. So in the 1930s, Jewish youth was very much organized into youth movements. 100,000 Polish Jews, sort of in their late teens, early 20s, were members of these youth movements. They were a little bit like the Scouts. Jews weren't allowed to join the Polish Scouts, so they sort of had started creating these in response to that. But these youth movements became spiritual, intellectual, social, emotional training grounds for the youth. They provided their value systems, their friendships, their ways of thinking. And the groups that I focus on in my story were largely socialist, secular groups who believed in equality. Women had much more equality than I had ever would have imagined before beginning to research this period. They believed in collectivism, self-sufficiency, pride, Jewish pride, pride in who they were, pride in their heritage, and the pursuit of truth and the acknowledgement of truth. And they were also interesting, very interesting to me, were focused on psychology, psychoanalysis even. They talked a lot about emotional awareness, understanding your own strengths and weaknesses. And altogether, these groups, in fact, I should say that many times youth left their families to move into communes with their groups. And this sometimes caused disruption in the family. The parents were upset that their child was leaving to move in with the Freedom Group or the Young Guard group. But that's how powerful and all-encompassing they were. And these groups later, in the ghettos, a couple of years into the war, are what transformed into these organized, really military underground units that I write about. And not only had women had leadership roles, they were taught in these groups to feel pride, to think critically, to know themselves, and they also had already lived together and worked together. So they had a very strong sense of how to collaborate. And I think all these qualities made them stronger underground fighting cells.
One of the things that is interesting, and this doesn't really point to specifically the women, but just to these young people, men and women both, who were so much of this resistance effort, that there was, especially in the early going, when this horror was just beginning to make itself known, that there was, to some extent, a difference of opinion between older folks and younger folks in terms of what should be done. And if there was any, if it made any sense whatsoever to try to resist what was going on, I mean, or to be open about that or aggressive about that. And that's really intriguing and something I'd not really read about before, that sort of generation gap when it came to trying to understand what was happening and what should be done about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I read about this time and time again in the memoirs of the youth of the time, and the community was obviously under horrific, I mean, the circumstances of their lives were horrible, torturous, and there was a lot of, no one knew how to deal with Nazi occupation. There was a lot of disagreement around how to handle this brutal, murderous occupation, and this is obviously a generalization, but there was often a sense that the older community leaders in the Jewish community felt that, you know, we're not going to beat the Nazis. We're not a military. The biggest militaries in the world can't defeat Hitler's army. So, you know, let's not go out and start upsetting them even more by doing, you know, rebel acts that we're not trained for. Whereas the youth felt that they're going to kill us all. you know, don't rock the boat. That makes no sense. The boat is sinking. We are all going to be killed. We have to do whatever we can to make a difference.
Hmm.
And so that was often the tension.
Right. You tell us that as the Jews began to be crowded into these terrible ghettos, that life was turned upside down, and that in many cases there were all kinds of role reversals that would occur for lots of different reasons in terms of what the men could and would be able to do versus the women. And that's just one reason why we find some of these young women figuring so prominently in the resistance movement. But there are other important factors that I want you to tell us about, particularly in the way that so many of these young women could serve so effectively as couriers. First of all, explain what's behind that intriguing term, courier, a term which some people misunderstand.
Sure. So many of the women that I write about, not all of them, but many of them were what were called courier girls. These were women, again, very young, usually late teens, early 20s, who looked good was the term, which meant that they could pass for non-Jews. They often were lighter skin tone, lighter hair, lighter eyes, and even those who weren't often dyed their hair. And the idea was that these courier girls would pretend to be Catholic or Christian Polish girls and leave the ghettos. Jews were not allowed to leave the ghettos. They were imprisoned. But these girls slipped out of the ghettos and had many roles doing undercover work, as they said, on the outside, on the Aryan side. And they, at the beginning of the war, they connected the ghettos. They brought information. In the ghettos, Jews weren't allowed to have radios or newspapers. They did not know what was happening. The courier girls brought information. They brought underground bulletins and newspapers. They brought medications. They brought the news about the Nazi genocidal plan. As the war went on and the youth movements developed into militias, as I was speaking of before, these courier girls became the ones who were arming the undergrounds in the ghettos. They were going out, meeting with weapons dealers, procuring guns, ammunition, supplies, clips of cartridges. They were hiding them on their bodies and bringing them into the ghettos to help arm them for uprisings. They also transported fake Aryan papers, money, and they also helped relocate some Jews, find them hiding places. They went to pay off the people who were hiding them. They brought medical care to Jews in hiding who needed care. So they were sort of had a special role because they were able to pretend to be Christian and work on the outside.
It's just fascinating, and I'm glad you clarify what we are talking about, because as you say in the book, some people would say that using the term courier might not do justice to the array of incredibly dangerous activities in which these women were engaging. It's incredible, and we should mention that although many of them perish in the effort, some of them do survive. And in fact, you are able to meet with the children of some of these incredibly brave women on several different occasions. One of the things you tell us in the book is about two different journeys you made to Poland, one in, I believe, 2007 and the other in 2018. And I appreciate the honesty with which you talk about what it was like to be in Poland and what you experienced there and what you describe, I think, at one point is two conflicting takes on this story. Explain what you mean.
I think what you're referring to is the, you know, all four of my grandparents were born and raised in Poland. So I feel a very strong connection to Poland, but also they all fled Poland because they were persecuted there. Even the ones who had left before the war left because of anti-Semitism. So I, on the one hand, really come from a Polish-Jewish history, of course. My family had been there for generations. And on the other hand, it's a complicated, ambivalent feeling about a country that my family left.
Mm. I think at one point you write, I felt connection and a new level of alienation and fear. And I guess what you're talking about there is between you and the nation of Poland.
Yeah, it's an ambivalent relationship. I mean, I was actually very taken by the people who helped me do this research in Poland. I don't speak Polish, so I had translators, researchers, fixers, drivers in Poland. And they were often, they were young. They were usually 20s, 30s, and they were so interested in this project. They did research on it for me. I hadn't hired them to do, you know, that a driver came and I researched this and I researched that and I researched that. Actually, they felt a lot of sort of pride in this story. It was part of their history as well. So that was very moving for me.
It's interesting. It reminds me of an experience I had some years ago in interviewing a Holocaust survivor from Poland. It was a remarkable conversation in many ways, but I still vividly remember a moment of great confusion when we were talking about something involving him hiding in the barn of a farm someplace in Poland. And somewhere in that telling, and I'm asking him now, so were they, but they were Polish, right? This was a, or they were Jewish, or we really got our signals crossed in terms of, are we talking about Jews in Poland or non-Jews in Poland? And he would say, oh, no, they were Polish. But what he was saying is these people who were not Jewish, they were Polish, but he himself and his family, we were Jewish, even though we lived in Poland. It was, in other words, as far as he was concerned, you know, that's the way you properly use those terms, that a Jew living in Poland is not Polish. They are Jewish. And your book spends a little time talking about this intriguing wrinkle when it comes to the matter of identity and how the Jews in Poland thought of themselves then and maybe to some extent think of themselves now.
Jews lived in Poland continuously for over 1,000 years. And in the 30s, I mean, right before the war, Jews made up, I think, 10% of the population of Poland. It was a really significant minority. And yet there were constant questions about identity, as you say. Do we belong or not? On the one hand, there was tremendous, I mean, especially the 1930s, almost a golden era of cultural production for Polish Jewry, universities and professorships, and there were 100, this fascinated me, there were 180 Jewish newspapers in Warsaw in the mid-30s. I mean, it's tremendous. So Jews had a very flourishing cultural life in Poland. At the same time, there was anti-Semitism. There were certain nationalist political parties that considered only Poles to be purebred Polish, and that Jews and other minorities were not actually Polish. And Jews, I think the Jewish community was constantly trying to figure out its own place in the country. Are we first class citizens or not? And these are questions that had started centuries earlier as well. When Jews were coming into Poland, you know, in the Middle Ages, you know, how did they belong? Were they Polish or not? And that sort of continued through.
Mm. It's a fascinating facet of this amazing story. And one last question. We've talked about the fact that you had to take your time before you could actually sit down and write this book. You tell us that you were about 40 years old then at that point. And in your words, this meant that you were having to face the Holocaust from a new perspective. What difference did it make for you in the writing of this book that you were not as young as you were when you sort of began this long journey? What kind of difference did it make in terms of the perspective it gave you?
That's a great question. You're asking good questions. I felt that it what you know when I first found the book, I was 30, or first found this inspiration. I was 30, and I was though I was older than the rebels in the story. I was kind of close-ish in age to them, in the sense I was single, I felt young, but at 40, I had children, I was married, and I had different anxieties and different concerns. And we talked a little bit before about the tensions between the older generation who were Jewish leaders in the ghetto and the younger Jews who said, you know, this is crazy, we have to fight. And I guess coming to it, myself being older, myself being a parent, I understood both sides of that tension. I also understood the Jewish leaders in the community who had families, who were terrified not just for their own lives but for the lives of their children. And that was something, of course, I hadn't understood when I was younger. But as a mother, you know, I also understood the need to not rock the boat, the fear of inflaming the Nazis. I think I just had a more balanced view of that tension.
Mm. Well, I appreciate the careful balance and meticulous insights that you share with us in this remarkable book, and we come away with tremendous sorrow for all of the losses that the Holocaust represents, but also come away with tremendous admiration for those who found ways to be part of the resistance against the Nazi horror. You've told this complicated story very, very well in your new book, The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos, published by William Morrow, the author Judy Battalion. Judy Battalion, thank you so much. It was a privilege for me to speak with you about your marvelous book.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the greatest privileges that I have had in my many years as host of The Morning Show is the honor of speaking with an array of Holocaust survivors. One of the most memorable of those conversations was with a dear woman from Racine by the name of Helen Eisenberg. And I wanted to replay just a portion of that conversation. This is towards the end of the interview, and by this point in Helen's story, she and some of her family had managed to escape Germany to settle here in the United States.
I began to realize very shortly how extremely fortunate I was that my parents and I could have come to the United States. And I became very patriotic. I wanted to do everything I could to help the war effort, like knitting for the Red Cross and saving tinfoil, all those things. And, of course, my parents watched the news, listened to the news daily. I mean, the radio was always on for every little bit of news. And we didn't know what had happened to my grandparents and other relatives. So my father was always searching for ways to maybe find out some of that information.
Hmm. Were you ever able to receive any sort of letters from them after you had departed?
Between the time we departed and the war started, we received a letter every week.
Really?
From my grandparents. A long letter from my grandfather and a shorter note from my grandmother. And these letters are, I always looked at them as the Anne Frank diary of a aging couple.
Huh.
That is how I saw them. At that time I read the letters. I was happy that, you know, they wrote. I was always mentioned in them. But then as I got older, and I started when I was in high school, when I read these letters, they broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I can barely read them. I always wanted to translate them for my children into English, but I still haven't been able to do it. They are the... It's a group of letters where every week you see a little bit more hope being lost, a little bit more despair.
As their situation worsens.
And as they begin to realize, and I think in the last letters you can really tell that they knew what was ahead of them.
Wow.
And my father compiled, he saved all the letters, he wrote an introduction to these letters, and he gave them to the Leo Beck Institute. That's a archive for German Jewish history in New York City. And they have offices in London, and now they have an office in Germany. And I think they have the largest collection of German Jewish history. And he gave it to them in their memory.
And you have these letters also.
I have copies. The originals are at the Leo Beck Institute, and I have the copies.
At one point, did the letters simply stop arriving? I mean, is that when essentially you knew something had happened?
Well, the letters stopped arriving the minute that the United States entered the war.
Ah. At what point did you ultimately learn about their fate? Was that not until the war was over?
We actually got two letters, short notifications through the American Red Cross from the concentration camp that they were in. They were in Theresienstadt, Terrassen.
Yes.
And that was, well, the Germans had really designated that as a model camp. They would show that camp off to visitors, or when the American Red Cross, not the International Red Cross, would come, they could in no time beautify it and have it look like it was really not so bad a place to be.
I have a compact disc recording of music that was composed by people at Theresienstadt, and things that were even presentations that would be made sometimes when Red Cross workers would come.
Right.
And it is so poignant to listen to that music, and both to think about somebody writing music in the face of all that. And also it's sad to think about some of that music, in a sense, being twisted into propaganda.
Exactly. I don't know. Do you know the book, I'll Never See Another Butterfly?
Sure.
That's from Theresienstadt. Mm. It was beautiful, poignant children's poems that were written during that time.
Yeah. So you did know something then of your grandparents' fate. When was it that you learned ultimately of their death?
There were only the letters that came, there were just two or three lines. And what we all noticed is my grandfather was extremely proud of his handwriting. He had a beautiful handwriting. And when the letters came, we saw that the deterioration in his handwriting.
Mm.
And then the last letter that came, it said, "Please, we are fine. Please do not worry about us. And we hope you are fine." And that was it.
Wow.
And I have those letters at home. Then after the war ended, we found out that they had died. The dates of their death and how they died of starvation. We found that out because my father was able, the lists became available. Lists became available with names of people who had survived. And my father went through that list and he found a couple of names, people he thought my grandparents might have gotten to know while they were in Theresienstadt, because they were from the same vicinity or they were distant relatives. And he contacted them. And then that was the first time that he knew for sure. And then after a while, we were able to find out from the German government and then from the Czechoslovakian government, because Theresienstadt is in Czechoslovakia.
Hmm.
And they had very, very accurate records. And I guess one thing you can say, they were methodical.
Hmm.
The records show that. It showed the date, the time of when they were deported, where they were deported from. Everyone assigned a number.
Hmm.
And So we were very fortunate because we were able, through these people who knew my grandparents at the concentration camp, to learn a little bit more about them and what they had been doing. And one of the things that really touched me, my grandfather during the First World War was in... there's a German name, but it's like a medic.
Huh.
Because there was a base hospital in Bensheim where they lived, and he was there taking care of German soldiers who were returned to that hospital. And then when he was in Theresienstadt, the last thing he did until he died, he again was a medic, and he took care.
Really?
Yeah.
There at the camp?
At the camp. And this one lady wrote that how kind he was to all these people, dying people.
I think it must be so interesting for you all these years later to be looking back at these events and looking back at them, I should think, differently. I mean, to experience them at the time as still, you know, a young person. And then as your life proceeds, as you marry, as you have children, to still, of course, be thinking about your grandparents and remembering this heartache, but seeing it differently, through the eyes of an adult.
And of course, and then also, I understood what actually happened because I read so many books on the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And went to lectures on the Holocaust, that I learned to look at it from a different view. One, I had the emotional view for a long, long time.
And nothing else.
And nothing else. Mm-hmm. And I think going back to Germany that was a hard decision. I always thought I would never go back. But my husband really wanted to go back, and I was so glad that I decided to go with him. I think it was, in many ways, healing. I don't believe in the word closure. There is no closure for something like that. But I do, I feel, I have many friends in Germany now. I love the young people.
Hmm.
I think they're wonderful. We've had them come and stay with us, and we really have some pretty close ties over there.
Hmm. And were you able to reconnect with people that you had known, for instance, in Stuttgart?
I wasn't able to reconnect with anybody in Stuttgart. And in Bensheim, I was able to reconnect with people who, I was able to reconnect with... people that knew me when I was a little girl.
Right, who remembered you, even if you probably didn't remember them.
And friends of my grandparents. I got to know several of my father's gymnasium professors, which was very... My father, because of his writings, having been a writer and an editor, was very well known.
Mm.
And people were interested in meeting his daughter.
I could see why. Here in America, you go through school. You, I assume, graduate from high school. And what happens to you from there?
I graduated from high school, and I went on to nursing school. After that, I met my husband. We were married, and we moved to Saratoga Springs, New York, after he graduated, after he got his master's degree. We moved to Saratoga Springs, New York, where he taught at Skidmore, and he went on to get his PhD from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. We had four children, and eventually, when he went to do a postdoctoral in Madison, and we decided to come to, Kenosha, and my husband was the first chair of the science division there.
At the University of Wisconsin, Parkside.
Yeah, right.
You mentioned the fact that for a long time you didn't talk much about this, that it was really, it sounds like you were following your husband's lead in some respects. in sharing about this. Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah. He talked about it more than I did. I think Norbert, because he left Germany in 1936, he didn't have the trauma the same way that I did.
Right.
But by talking to him and by talking to other people, I became more willing. I really felt I had to trust someone in order to speak to them about what happened. And until, like I said, I saw the necessity of really being a witness to what happened.
As you raised your four children, how much would you talk about this with them?
That's a real interesting question, because there's so many Holocaust survivors didn't talk to their children at all.
Really?
Some didn't even know they were children of Holocaust survivors. Hmm. But I was used to talking. My father talked to me, and he wrote about the Holocaust, and that's because he was a writer. And so it was just natural for me to talk to my children about it. And they, from day one, knew what had happened to their families in the Holocaust. I think that, I don't think it affected their life in it. We didn't frighten them with it. We just told them the facts. We told them how important our heritage was to us and that we hoped it would be important to them. And then we took them on a trip to Germany and showed them Norbert's, where Norbert's family had come from, where I had come from. And they met some of these people I told you in Bensheim that that had known my parents and had known me as a child. And we visited the cemeteries, and we try to do a family tree. We try to trace back our ancestry to as long as we can, could. And our children were different, of course, were different ages when we took them, and they responded differently to it. To one of our children, it was just a great vacation. Very, very excited about it. One of our other children did not think it was right for us to go back to Germany. Another son became very, very interested in the Holocaust, and he became a history major, actually.
Wow.
And he's probably read every book on the Holocaust that's available. But I think, in general, I think our children knew how grateful we were to be in this country. They knew how Norbert and I were thankful every day of our life, really, that we were spared. And I think that was transmitted to them, because they have a great interest in this country. They have historical interest in what's going on in the world, and they've even passed some of that on to my grandchildren.
A portion of the conversation which I recorded some years ago with Holocaust survivor Helen Eisenberg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, paying his monthly visit to the program. On Thursday's program, we will be talking about a couple of different musical events. First of all, we'll be previewing for you the next concert of the Racine Symphony Orchestra, which will include the latest winner of their Young Artist Competition. Also, I'll be speaking with Dr. Wael Farouk from the music faculty at Carthage College. He recently had the extraordinary experience of performing all three piano concertos by Russian composer Sergei Rachmaninoff in a single evening. The recording of that amazing achievement will be shared with the public very, very shortly. And on Friday, a preview of the next